Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back here, particularly on such a beautiful day. And, you know, referring to my cutting, my wife always refers to me as a cut-up. But, but, you know, medicine was something that was always very, very interesting to me. And initially, I wanted to be a missionary doctor because, you know, I would hear the stories, and it was so inspiring, these people who would go all over the world at great personal sacrifice. I actually have a good friend now who does missionary doctor work. He's a surgeon. And I got a call from him, a frantic call about 2 months ago. And he was just distraught because one of the villages that he used to go to in Iraq, he went there and everybody had been killed. Except for the women who had been carried away. I mean, it was just horrible, the kinds of things that are going on. But, you know, later on in high school, I decided, you know, I'd rather be rich, so missionary doctor was out. And then I decided, you know, psychiatrists, they seem like rich people. I want to be a psychiatrist, because all they have to do is talk to crazy people all day. And it seemed like I was doing that anyway. So I said, you know, this is going to work out extremely well. And in college, you know, I took courses from people like Anna Freud, Sigmund Freud's daughter. I was all gung-ho. But then in medical school, I started meeting a bunch of psychiatrists. So I said, no, that's not going to work. I'm just kidding. Some of my best friends are psychiatrists. But you know, I really started thinking, what are you really, really good at? Because I actually believe that God gives everybody special gifts and talents. There's no one that he has forgotten. And I started thinking about my life, and I realized that I had a lot of eye-hand coordination. I was able to think in three dimensions. I was a very careful person. I never knocked things over and said, oops. It's a good characteristic for a brain surgeon, by the way. And I love to dissect things. So, you know, I kind of put all that together, and that's what made me decide on neurosurgery. And, you know, the career that God gave me in neurosurgery was unbelievable. If somebody had sat me down in front of a computer and said, I want you to type out the career that you would like to have, I could not have come up with a better scenario. And the interesting thing is there were so many once-in-a-lifetime cases, one after another, which quickly raised, you know, my profile. And, you know, I was starting to wonder, why is all this happening to me? But it was only later that I was able to figure out why the Lord gave me such an amazing, basically untouchable career. And then, you know, I was invited to sit on corporate boards. I said, neurosurgeons don't sit on multinational corporate boards. What is this? But again, I think it was the good Lord giving me a lot of experience in economics and in business, areas that I wouldn't normally do, and started traveling so much, 57 different countries, and, you know, getting to know people in all kinds of places. And I remember openly questioning, Lord, what are you up to? And then I really began to question it when I got the invitation to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast. Because I had spoken 17 years earlier. I said, Lord, what do you want me to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast? Because no one had ever done it twice that I knew of. And then I found out one person had, that was Billy Graham. Then I really knew he was up to something. But I really didn't know what I was supposed to talk about. I kept writing down things. I say, no, that's not what it is. I was doing that right up until the night before the speech. And I just went to sleep. And when I woke up that morning, it was so clear what I was supposed to say. And obviously, it resonated with millions of people. And, you know, people started saying, you should run for president, which I thought was ridiculous. And I said, that'll all die down. But it never did. It kept building up. And as I started talking to people around the country, the one thing that impressed me the most was how many people particularly elderly people, said they had given up, that they didn't recognize this as America anymore, and that they were just waiting to die. I heard that so many times, it really hit me. And then younger people who were so concerned about their children and their grandchildren, and I began to realize that America, as we know it, was slipping away from us. Actually, it was more than slipping. It was moving at rapid speed away from us. And that it would be necessary to be able to take a stand. At some point, people have to wake up to the degree that they are willing to stand up for what they believe in. And, you know, I've always been, you know, I'm not an in-your-face type person, but I don't back down easily. By any stretch of the imagination, don't give up. Never give up. You know, that was Winston Churchill's commencement speech once. And it was the shortest commencement speech in history. It was never give up. Never, never give up. Never, never, never give up. Thank you. I mean, but it made an impression. And it's always made an impression on me. The other thing that made a big impression on me was my mother. And by the way, thank everybody who's been praying for my mother. She's doing better than ever now. She's, you know, and it's just amazing. It's amazing what God can do. And, but she never allowed us to make excuses. And we didn't like that very much. Everybody else got to make excuses. Why couldn't we make excuses? But as soon as we would make an excuse, out of her mouth would come the poem, "Yourself to blame. You're the captain of your ship," and on it would go. And we didn't want to hear that poem anymore, so we stopped making excuses. And I think that was probably the most important thing that she did for us, because in the environment where we grew up, people were always saying, "You can't do that. The system's against you. This is against you." I can't tell you how many times I heard, "You can't do that." And, you know, I learned how to ignore that. And in my medical career, I can't tell you how many times I heard people say, "You can't do that. No one's done that before." But if I had listened to those people, there'd be a lot of kids who would not have survived. And, you know, one of the wonderful things that I get to experience now, having operated on nearly 15,000 people, as virtually any place that I travel, there's a patient or a family member or somebody who knows one of my patients. It's almost ubiquitous. And it's so wonderful to see them and see what happens. I remember, you know, how people were very skeptical when I sort of resurrected the operation called hemispherectomy, where you take out half the brain to stop intractable seizures. It had fallen out of favor because the complication rate was too high, morbidity and mortality. And yet, about 3 months ago, when I was in Kentucky, I ran into a patient I had done a hemispherectomy on when he was a baby, 20 years ago. And he and his family were there, and he had graduated from college, number one in his class. With half a brain. It makes you wonder. I should open a shop up in Washington, D.C. But you know, when I really stop and start thinking about what's happening in our nation today, it really is no laughing matter. You look at how divided we are as a nation right now. There are some people say, "Oh, it's always been like that." It has not always been this way. And I actually believe that it is intentional. I believe there are certain people, the purveyors of division, who do this for a reason. War on women, age wars, income wars, racial wars, religious wars, any kind of war they can possibly stir up to keep the people at each other's throats. A wise man by the name of Jesus once said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Never has stood, never will stand. And the fact of the matter is, we live in dire times because there are people outside of this nation who want to destroy us. They want to destroy our way of life. And the best thing that we can do to help them is to fight each other. You know, we have to be smart enough to recognize that we are not each other's enemies. And we cannot continue to fan the flames of division because there is no way that we will survive the war against the jihadist if we don't recognize that our strength lies in our unity. And that means we have to learn that it's okay to disagree with somebody. That doesn't make them your enemy just because you disagree with them. What it means is that people have to learn how to engage in dialogue. Talk about your differences. Talk about what you're trying to achieve. You think about divorce. When people get, before they get divorced, what do? They stop talking. The next thing you know, their spouse is the devil incarnate. You know, that's what happens when you stop talking. So we have to really begin to engage once again in dialogue. And I like to engage in dialogue with liberals, to be honest with you, because, you know, they usually don't have anything behind what they advocate. And that becomes very clear very quickly in the conversation. And if you do it in a nice way, without rubbing it in their face, very frequently they actually begin to understand what you're talking about. You know, I remember, you know, a few months ago when I went to New York to speak at Al Sharpton's conference, you know, a lot of conservatives said, "You're crazy. What are you doing? I can't support you anymore. You're just terrible. You have no judgment to go and talk to those people." Well, you know, I wasn't going to talk to Al Sharpton. I was going to talk to the audience. And when he introduced me, he said, "You know, Carson and I don't agree on anything." He says, "I doubt we could agree that today is Wednesday." But he's had a stellar career, lots of accomplishments, and we should listen to what he has to say. And the audience was like, "Oh my God, are you kidding me? We listen to this guy? Oh my God, no." But you know, I got up and I started talking about empowerment. I started talking about living independently rather than being dependent on the government. And how do you do that? I started talking about how you turn dollars over in your own community a couple of times before you send them out to create wealth and reach back and pull other people with you. And how you really achieve that level of independence. I started talking about the contributions that black people had made to building America, which most of them didn't know. I ended talking about Elijah McCoy. Elijah McCoy was a black inventor who invented the locomotive's lubrication system. In fact, he had so many inventions, when something new would come out, people would say, "Is that a McCoy? Is that the real McCoy?" That's right. You know, and you know, they were like blown away. And by the time I finished, standing ovation, they all wanted pictures and autographs. And Al Sharpton's like, "Are these my people? What are they doing?" You know, but the fact of the matter is, you know, it's important, you know, that we as a nation become united again. And we do things that work for everybody. I mean, I think that is really the key here. Not picking out special groups, and certainly not being involved with special interest groups. You know, when you go to Washington and you open the lid to look underneath to see what makes it run, you just want to close it down. I mean, it is corrupt, believe me. And with so many special interest groups, anything that comes out of Washington doesn't make any sense. Guaranteed, there's a special interest group behind it. And I absolutely refuse to get involved with any special interest groups. I will not do it. I would much rather lose than get involved with a special interest group, except for one special interest group, and that is the American people, because that is the only special interest group that we should be concerned about. And it is so vitally important that the people themselves begin to think for themselves. Don't allow themselves to be manipulated by people on the right or the left. That's why God gave us these amazing brains. He made us in his image. And we have a brain that's able to extract information from the past and the present and to integrate it into a plan and project it into the future. We can control our own destiny, but we have to be responsible. And this is a republic-type government, which means a representative-type government. But it doesn't work unless we know who our representatives are and unless we know whether they really represent us and do they vote the way we want them to vote. Because if we don't seize control of that, what we end up with is a political class, the people who just, you know, you see their name and you say, oh, I know that name. Okay, I'm voting for that one. Have no idea who they are or what they represent, or whether they're even remotely in the same boat as you are, philosophically. That has to change. Being informed is so important. Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson especially talked about how incredibly important it is for the populace to be informed. And he said, that is really the key to our freedom and our system of government. And if the people ever become uninformed, that the nature of the country would rapidly change. Why? Because then all it would take is a slick politician to come in and say stuff and people, oh, yeah, right. That's what we have now. You know, we have a president, an administration that comes in and says, hey, everybody, the economy is great. You know, we're down to like 5.5% unemployment. Let me tell you, 5% unemployment is full employment. Do we have full employment? No, we do not have full employment. And it's very frustrating because a lot of his followers, you know, they're saying, yeah, Obama said everything's great. This is wonderful. But I can't find a job. Why can't I find a job if everything is so wonderful? And I think that's one of the reasons you have these tinderboxes in our inner cities, that the exploiters know how to come in and stir up and create a huge problem for everybody. And that's why what we're going to have to do fundamentally is fix the economy. That is really, I think, at the root of many of the other problems that we are having in this country. We have a national debt that this by the end of this year will be $18.6 trillion. Our GDP this year will be $18 trillion. So this is the first year since World War II that our GDP will be less than our national debt. That is a horrible situation. Economists will tell you that when the GDP to debt ratio reaches 90%, usually growth stops. Our growth is not going anywhere right now. In fact, we're shrinking at this stage of the game. And that's just going to continue to get worse as our debt load continues to increase. Now, $18.6 trillion, think about how much money that is. That you probably can't even comprehend that number. Just take it back to $18 trillion. If you tried to pay that off at a rate of $10 million a day, 365 days a year, it would take you over 5,000 years. Okay. That's what we're offloading on our children. But I got news for you. That's not the worst part. There was something called the fiscal gap. Anybody who knows much about economics knows what I'm talking about. Fiscal gap is you look at the unfunded liabilities going into the future, and then you look at the receipts that are respected. and expect it to come in. And then you evaluate that based on today's dollars. That gives you the so-called fiscal gap. And when you go home today, look it up on the internet, fiscal gap. There's a guy named Larry Kutlikoff, a tremendous economist. And you know, it was interesting because I mentioned the fiscal gap during my announcement speech. And the next day, a bunch of liberal newspapers came out and said, Carson says $211 trillion? How could he say something like that? He has no idea what he's talking about. And then the next day, Bloomberg came out with an article that says, 17 Nobel laureates in economics and 1,200 economics professors agree with Carson. So that kind of was the end of the left picking on me for that. And they want to change the conversation and say, isn't he the guy who says being gay is a choice? You know, I mean, they always want to change it to some other thing. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, the kind of debt that we have is unsustainable. We are on a precipice economically, very, very close to destruction. And what is happening? We're adding more debt. You know, we're bringing in people from the outside, anchor babies and all kinds of things, and giving them benefits and exploding the deficit even more. Does that make any sense at all? It's almost like we want to destroy our nation. And I hope that's not the case. But what I do know is that it's not too late. I do know that we can do something about this, but it's going to require every single one of us to use their influence and their sphere of influence. Just like in the pre-Revolutionary War, you know, those pioneers, they started having town hall meetings. They would call their friends and neighbors in, and they would talk about what kind of country do we want to have, and what are we willing to do? And they encouraged each other. And that's how a ragtag bunch of militiamen defeated the most powerful and professional army on the face of the earth. We have to do that again. We have to start talking to everybody, because you see, in 2012, 93 million people who could have voted did not vote. 30 million evangelicals did not vote. We have to get to those people. We have to make sure that they're registered to vote. We have to make sure that they understand what is at stake in our country. Because I tell you, if the people with common sense who have real values in this country would stand up, the progressives would be dwarfed. They would be dwarfed. There's nothing that they could do. And what has happened is Saul Alinsky, in his book Rules for Radicals, he's a very clever guy. And he said, we have to achieve certain positions, which they've done. And then we have to make the majority believe that what they think is no good. No one thinks that way who's intelligent. And only the way we think is the right way to think. And that way, they'll shut up. That's all they want. They don't care whether you disagree with them or not, as long as you shut up. As long as you don't stand up for what you believe in and allow them to drive the boat. And that's exactly what's happening in our country today. And we have the power to change that. We also have to recognize that we are at great risk because of the Islamic jihadists who want to destroy us. This is a very different situation than existed in 2003 when we invaded Iraq, which I personally was not in favor of, because I didn't see how that was vital to the interests of this country. I did think Saddam was a horrible guy, but I think there are lots of other ways to get rid of him than to go in and destabilize that situation. You don't want to destabilize a situation where you have, you know, both of your enemies fighting each other. Just, you know, let them continue to do that. You don't want to go in and destabilize that. But we did. And then, you know, fortunately, we have tremendous military leaders. And General Petraeus, you know, he may have had some personal failings, but he was a great leader. I know him. He's a smart guy. And we had a lot of really smart guys in the military. And they were able to achieve a victory in that very difficult situation. The problem was, then we withdrew. We snatched defeat from the jaws of victory and created a much more unstable situation than ever existed before, and created the atmosphere that would allow for ISIS to occur. Now, when ISIS was early on, they had 10,000 people there out in the desert. We knew where they were. We should have destroyed them then, without question. And there were some of our military people advocating that, but this president wouldn't hear of it. And now they continue to grow and to expand. And the reason that they're being so successful in recruiting is because, you know, they do things like conquer cities that we had previously held. And now Baghdad is under threat. And if they take Baghdad, they're going to have, you know, tremendous propaganda value. All of these things are hurting us. Every single day that we allow them to expand and grow is another day that's going to cost us more lives and more money. That's all there is to it. Our only choice is to destroy them while we can. And I say that I'm a dove, but I'm what's known as a pragmatic dove. Pragmatic doves do not allow themselves to be destroyed. They will do what they need to do to preserve themselves. You know, but we also have to recognize that we have to take a much more proactive stance in the world as the pinnacle nation, because we encourage adventurism by others who are not nearly as benign as we are, as we vacate. And that, again, is going to cost us. You know, look at how aggressive China is getting, you know, throughout the South China Sea, and that's just going to continue to expand. Look at North Korea, look at Iran, look at Putin, who would love to reestablish a Soviet Union, an empire. And, you know, it's so obvious what we need to do. You know, Ukraine was a nuclear state, and they relinquished their nuclear weapons with the understanding that if they were attacked, we would protect them. Did we protect them? No. Did we even give them offensive weapons? No. Now, don't you think the rest of the world is seeing this? When we renege on our responsibilities, we turn our backs on our allies like Israel, you know, what we are doing is establishing chaos in the world. All of this is going to cost us in the long run. And we have to be smart enough to be able to look down the road and see what's going on. We're blessed in this country, because I know a lot of them. But people who are incredibly smart, incredibly talented, and, you know, a good commander-in-chief actually knows how to utilize those people. You know, the Bible in Proverbs 11:14 says, in the multitude of counselors is safety. You know, you look at George Washington, our first president. He only had 4 cabinet members, but they were wise people. And he consulted them about everything, and they did an amazing job. And that's what happens. We have to recognize that when we look at the system that we have now, it is supposed to be about the people. It is not supposed to be about any one person. It is not supposed to be really about any one party. It is supposed to be about the will of the people, of, for, and by the people. The government is there to facilitate the will of the people, to promote life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the reason that I personally have been such a vehement opponent of Obamacare is because it turns that whole system upside down. It fundamentally changes the relationship between the government and the people. Instead of the people telling the government what to do, it's the government saying, this is what we're going to do. We don't care whether you like it or not. This is just the way it is. We're shoving it down your throat. And if we tolerate that, if we tolerate that, then we will tolerate anything. And pretty soon, we will not have the America that those who preceded us fought so hard to deliver to us. And you know, it was just a little while ago that we celebrated 71 years as D-Day. You think about those guys who ran onto that beach, being slaughtered hundreds at a time, stepping over the dead bodies of their comrades, knowing in many cases they'd never see their loved ones or their homeland. Why would they do that? They did it for us, so that we could be free. We cannot allow what they did to be wasted by being timid right now. And this is the time that we have to be willing to stand up courageously. And, you know, I'm going to do it. I hope everybody here is going to do it. Because if we do, there is no way that God will not continue to bless our country. Thank you so much.
Thank you.